If you could grab your Bible from behind you and just turn up 2 Corinthians, which is on page 1096. So we're going to be looking today, this morning, at chapter 4 and verses 1 to 12. That's in 2 Corinthians. And when you've got that, I'm just going to read it to you. Corinthians 4:1. Therefore, since through God's mercy we have this ministry, we do not lose heart. Rather, we have renounced secret and shameful ways. We do not use deception, nor do we distort the word of God. On the contrary, by setting forth the truth plainly, we commend ourselves to everyone's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are perishing. The God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers, so that they cannot see the light of the gospel that displays the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may also be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. So over the next 3 months, we're going to be spending our Sunday mornings in 2 Corinthians. And we're diving into the letter at chapter 4. And I thought it was quite important that I try and give you some of the background, some of the context to the letter more generally before we come and look at those verses that we just read. Corinth was a wealthy city in what we call the country of Greece. It had a population of roughly 500,000 people, which I think is about twice the size of Tower Hamlets. It was an important city in terms of trade routes. It was famous for its pagan temples, especially a temple to the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And it was also famous for its immorality. You may have heard that in 2013, there's a new word that's been added to the English dictionary, and that's the word selfie. And I guess that you know that a selfie is a picture taken with the camera pointing back at yourself. Well, I am told that around about that time, there was a new word in that region, and that was the word to Corinthianize. It's a verb, to Corinthianize. So that was added to the ancient Greek dictionary. And it meant to pursue immorality of various kinds. Corinth was so renowned for its immorality that they even came up with a new word to Corinthianize. Corinth also liked to dabble in philosophy and in wisdom. And there was quite a culture of power. They had the great god Zeus as quite a big feature in their thinking. On his first missionary visit there, Paul planted a church. But after he left to visit other churches, things had not gone very smoothly at Corinth. Perhaps not surprisingly, it was a complicated and rather messy church. There were divisions in the church. Some preferred one apostle over another and began to form different groups under different apostles. There was also an unhealthy focus on the more spectacular, powerful spiritual gifts, the gift of speaking in tongues, for example. The Corinthian believers liked things to be impressive and powerful. There'd even been some issues with sexual immorality in the church. And Paul had written to the Corinthian church about some of these issues in his first letter, which is 1 Corinthians. And he'd instructed the church in that letter on church discipline issues and how they should treat the brother who had been sinning. But something else had happened in Paul's absence. There were some other ministers who Paul calls super apostles who had found their way into the church. And these super apostles had attracted the attention of the believers there because they had a message that seemed to be just the sort of thing that the church was into. It was a message about signs and wonders and power. They were slick. They were impressive. And the church thought they were terrific. And little by little, they began to draw the church away from Paul and his message. They began to look down on Paul's ministry as being inferior, perhaps, and even began to doubt that it was the genuine gospel. Paul seemed to make such heavy work of the Christian life. Paul's ministry was beset with difficulty and suffering and setbacks. Why would they want to subscribe to that sort of deal? And so Paul writes 2 Corinthians with the purpose of showing the believers there what true gospel ministry and life looks like. He says true, genuine, gospel-centered life looks like weakness. Just look back, if you would, at 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 8. Just over the page. 2 Corinthians 1 verse 8 says, "We do not want you to be uninformed, brothers, about the hardships we suffered in Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired even of life." Paul knew from painful experience that the gospel way is a way of suffering, of difficulty, of hardship. And it must be like this, because that is the essence of the gospel. The cross of Christ did not look like power and success. It looked like failure. It looked like a waste. It seemed to be a disappointment. It looked like weakness. And yet, it was the most powerful event that has ever occurred in the history of time. And that cross is the very center of our faith and must be the pattern for our life and our gospel work. It is not about slick presentation and powerful deeds, but it is about taking up our cross and following Jesus. The story is told of a Scottish man whose wife signed him up to do an evening class in jewellery and precious stones. On the first evening, he went along, rather reluctantly, and the teacher gave each member of the class a diamond and a magnifying glass, and he instructed them to sit down at their tables and to look at the diamond through the magnifying glass, and to keep looking at it. And they did that for the hour of the lesson until it was time to go home. The next week they arrived at the class, and the teacher gave them a diamond and a magnifying glass, and they looked at it for an hour, and then they went home. And the same thing happened the next week, and the next week, until by the sixth week, the gentleman was beginning to get a bit frustrated, and he began to complain. He said, I paid good money for this class. I've been coming each week, and all we get to do is to look at a diamond. And to top it all, the diamond they've given us this week, it isn't even real. It's not genuine. It's a fake. So as we read 2 Corinthians and study it together, that's what we're doing. We're looking together at the real gospel. Paul is giving us the magnifying glass and the diamond. And we're looking and looking again. And so we're very clear about what genuine gospel-centered work and gospel-centered living looks like. And we can spot the fakes when they come along. Just before we get to chapter 4, the bit of the letter we read, let's just have a brief look at chapter 3. In chapter 3, Paul begins to target some of his remarks at the so-called super apostles. In their application for the post of church leader in Corinth, they'd brought all sorts of letters of recommendation. On paper, they looked pretty good. They had excellent references. Paul says to the church, "We don't need those bits of paper. They don't count for much. What counts is you. You Corinthian believers, you are all the references we need. Your changed lives are a letter from Christ that everyone can read. Everyone can see the results of our ministry. Our message has not been about impressive presentation, but it has been about lives that have been transformed by the power of God. You believers have been changed, are being changed, and will be changed incredibly into something that looks like the glory of God. The same glory that we see in the face of Jesus Christ. Therefore, verse 1, chapter 4, we do not lose heart. We do not lose heart. Because we have this ministry that changes lives forever, we do not lose heart. We are facing opposition. We are facing difficulty. It may look weak, but we do not lose heart. And that phrase, do not lose heart, is an interesting one too. It means we do not grow weary. We do not give up. We don't behave differently when we're put under pressure. We don't change the message when opposition comes. And Paul, again, with those super apostles, those people who had set themselves up and were impressive, he has those in his sights as he begins to defend the message that he preached. As he does so, he holds up his own life and ministry, if you like, as the genuine diamond. This is what the ministry and life of the genuine gospel worker will look like. This is how his CV will read. And so as we look at these verses, I've got 2 points to make this morning. Firstly, when facing extreme difficulty, gospel workers still preach Christ. And secondly, when facing extreme difficulty, gospel workers are not defeated, but experience the power of God. I should just add at this point that I think Paul's remarks are perhaps primarily addressed to preachers of the gospel and those involved in Christian work and Christian teaching. But I've called it gospel workers for a reason, because we're all, in a sense, gospel workers. We're all commissioned to go and take the gospel to all nations. The message is for all of us. So firstly, when facing extreme difficulty, gospel workers still preach Christ. It seems that Paul is going through his CV with the believers in Corinth. He says, "My references are good." As we've seen, they are your changed lives. But my qualifications are good too. What qualifies me to preach the gospel? It is God's mercy. By God's mercy, I have seen the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. on the Damascus Road, the blindingly bright light of the glory of God shone on Paul, and he saw Jesus Christ. And this is what qualifies him to be a true apostle. He has seen the glory of God in the face of Christ, and it changed him forever. So Paul then starts to tell them, how do we recognize the genuine gospel worker? And by implication, he points out how the super apostles are not true and genuine. Despite all their show of power, they are not the real thing, but Paul is. When facing hard times, the true gospel worker will not lose heart. Paul says we don't change the message when things get difficult or when we don't see success. And he then gives them three things that the true gospel worker will not do. Firstly, they will not deceive. Secondly, they will not distort or dilute. And thirdly, they will not distract. The true gospel worker will not deceive. They are open about the message. They don't hide anything. And they don't preach with secret motives or for personal gain. If you again just look back at 2 Corinthians 2, chapter 2 and verse 17. Verse 17 says, unlike so many, we do not peddle the word of God for profit. On the contrary, we speak before God with sincerity, like men sent from God. Seems that these apostles, the other apostles, were trying to make money out of being Christian leaders. They were after large salaries and comfortable lives. And the true gospel worker does not distort or dilute the message. They don't make it say what they want it to say, and they don't add stuff that isn't there. He says, we haven't just thought up a nice message. We simply preach what's there. And the idea behind these words, I think, is the same sort of practice that drug dealers sometimes use. They cut the drug with something else that looks similar, but it is not the real thing. And that's what the super apostles had been doing, adding stuff that looked similar, but was not the true gospel. Paul says, we've kept the message the same. We haven't added something that looks the same just to make it look like you're getting more for your money. And then Paul says, the genuine gospel worker does not distract. We don't preach ourselves, he says. We don't distract from the message of the gospel. Perhaps there's always a temptation to preach ourselves, to try to be popular or somehow special. Perhaps we start to think that the power of the message somehow depends on the presentation of it, to think that it'll only be a powerful gospel if we're powerful preachers. Paul says, no, that's not how it is. Perhaps this is particularly a temptation when the pressure increases, when the difficulties come, and we begin to look at our own resources, turn to our own strengths, and we forget that it's not about us. It is about Christ. We don't change lives. Christ does. We don't open blind eyes. Christ does. It is when people see the light of the glory of God as they look at the face of Jesus that they are changed. Let's not lose our confidence in the power of the gospel to change lives. Christ is our message. We preach Christ, not ourselves. He is the Lord, not us. We do have a role, of course. What is our role? We are servants. Servants of God's people. The leadership team, the preaching team, we are your servants. Let's not put our leaders on pedestals. Paul goes on in verse 7 to talk about jars of clay. And he says, ministers are like jars of clay. We are clay pots. Not attractive, not impressive. Actually, pretty fragile. I wonder if we sometimes focus too much on the clay pots. I recently heard someone from another church say something like this about their leader. He said, "We're so lucky to have him as our pastor. He's such an excellent Bible teacher." And don't get me wrong, I think we should value excellent Bible teaching and be thankful for our teachers. But remember, they are just clay pots at the end of the day, fragile, weak, unimpressive clay pots. You don't glory in the clay pot. You glory in the treasure that's inside it. When facing tough times, we don't look for powerful, impressive leaders. What we do is we preach Christ. My second point this morning, then, when facing extreme difficulty, gospel workers are not defeated, but rather experience God's power. So Paul has taken us through his CV. So far, he's given us his references. He says we have qualifications. We've seen his qualifications to be a minister. It's God's mercy. Through God's mercy, he's seen the glory of God. And now he tells us about his previous experience. Just look down with me at verses 8 and 9. His previous experience. The genuine gospel worker is hard-pressed on every side, verse 8. That is, they are under extreme pressure, surrounded, feeling the pressure from all angles, feeling trapped, perhaps. They are hard-pressed. The genuine gospel worker is perplexed. That is, they are facing situations where they just don't know what to do next. They are completely at a loss to know what they should do. What direction should they go in? The genuine gospel worker is persecuted. That is, they are being pursued, running from the enemy's advance. And then they are struck down. They are at their lowest point, left for dead, depressed. Their hope is fading. That's Paul's previous experience. Does that sound like a powerful ministry to you? If that person applied for leadership in your church, would you employ them? Maybe some of that sounds like your experience too. Well, says Paul, that is what the authentic gospel ministry looks like. It looks like weakness. And yet, we've missed something important out. Just look down at verse 8 again. They are under extreme pressure, but not crushed. Completely at a loss to know what to do, but not despairing. Not completely lost, running from the enemy's advance, but not left behind. And the picture there may be like those war films that you see where the army is retreating and one soldier falls down, but he is not left to the mercy of the enemy because some brave soldier goes back to pick him up and drag him to safety. And the genuine gospel worker is struck down, depressed, left for dead, but not losing all hope. It may seem that you would be defeated. It may look like you have been defeated, but you are not. Why? Because God's power is at work. You are a weak clay pot gospel worker, but there is treasure inside. It is the treasure of the ministry of the gospel that changes lives. And the point here is this: our lives look like weakness. They look like fragile clay pots, so that God's power is more clearly and obviously seen. And it is an awesome power. The word there is the same word that we get our word dynamite from. It is explosive. It is mighty. It is like a volcanic eruption that blows the top off a mountain. There is no mistaking where that power comes from. Certainly not from the clay pot. And it's not just enough power. It's all-surpassing power, extravagant, excessive, over-the-top power. This is what is at work in the true gospel worker. This mighty power transforming us in our weakness and transforming those who listen. Paul goes on to talk about how this ministry brings life out of death. The clay pot ministry looks so weak, it seems like it's going to die. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus. It's as though we are dying too. As we get closer to Jesus, we experience more of what he experienced. Just as Jesus faced weakness and rejection and suffering in his life, that is what we experience too, says Paul. But we experience this so that his life may be revealed in us. It is so that his resurrection power will be at work, and it is at work now. This life from the dead, grave-busting power, is at work now and will be at work later. And as we go through this time of suffering, this time of weakness, this time that looks like we've been defeated, we experience God's life-giving power. But not only us, you also. You believers, you also know this life-giving power because in a sense we've suffered for your benefit, says Paul. It changes us, but it also changes you. That is sometimes our experience, isn't it? When we preach or teach the gospel, it changes us. Sometimes that is a painful thing. But we trust that it also changes those who listen. I realize that those verses 10 to 12 are pretty hard to grasp. And I'm sure there's so much more that could be said about them. They may even seem a bit foreign to us because we enjoy so much security and comfort and experience so little persecution in our country. But let me read to you from a book which is called Faith Under Fire, which some of you may have read. It's written by Andrew White, who is the vicar of Baghdad, or so he's termed, in a church in Baghdad. And he recalls the awful events of 31st of October, 2010, when Al-Qaeda terrorists entered the Syrian Catholic Church in Baghdad and shot people dead. They scattered grenades and finally blew people up with a suicide bomb. In all, 58 people were killed. He says, "I didn't know whether people would dare to return to the church the following week. They were so frightened. Many wanted to leave. As ever, many were determined to stay, but their number has decreased. The week after this tragedy, I spoke on Romans 8, 18 to 21. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us." He then says, "We really do suffer with Christ, but we really do see his glory. We know that whatever happens, the Lord will sustain us and help us through our difficulties. The resounding message from the congregation was that they would not be deterred by the threats and intimidation because Jesus was still with them. Despite the terrible things that have happened, they and I have resolved to stay. We know that the Lord is here and his Spirit is with us." We do not lose heart. it may seem like weakness. We may feel isolated, but God is at work. So we do not give up. We do not walk away. We don't lose our passion. So as I finish, let me ask, has it been a tough year for us as a church? Did you struggle to know what to say in your Christmas letter? Or when people asked you, how are things going at church? Does it feel like we're facing extreme difficulty? Does it look like weakness? Are you perplexed about the situation and what the new year will look like? I think the answer is yes. Yes to all those questions. And so what will we do in 2014? What is our plan? Well, don't lose heart. Don't stop preaching Christ. Don't let's think that because it's hard or it looks weak, that we're doing something wrong. Remember that we are not defeated, that in our weakness, the power of God is at work and is more clearly seen.